FSN Radio.
It's all about what's next.
Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports.
The Financial Survival Network.
It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. Hopefully you're even watching on YouTube. Well, we know these are tumultuous times. We've got the election coming up in less than 2 weeks. And, well, the economy is a mess, and still, nonetheless, from the COVID-induced global collapse been going on. You know, we're getting here 7 months now, almost 8 months, really. And, well, we're always trying to bring you new opinions, new viewpoints, so you can get the information that you need to make the decisions that are really crucial, that are going to affect your future, your family, and so many other issues, so many other levels. It's like an onion. You keep peeling off the outer layers and more issues come up. In any event, we'd like to get your opinion. How you're preparing? Are you ready for the concept of post-election civil unrest, violence? It's very likely. Like I said, bringing you new people, new viewpoints is really what we're about. This person is coming to you from Europe, from Paris. His name is Octavio Morenzi. Octavio, you're CEO of Apimus LLC, and well, you've been around the financial world for a lot of years. You know, we have a tendency, Octavio, when we've been around things for so long, to think that you've actually seen it all. And then something like the pandemic comes along and you realize, wow, maybe I haven't seen it all. So we welcome you to the show. Let's take a look at current markets. What's going on here? Why does the stock market in the U.S. at least keep going up? Why do we have real estate prices keep going higher, and yet the entire global economy seems to be falling apart at the seams?
Well, I think the main and the only reason for that really is the monetary policy of the central bank. So back in the middle of March, when the markets were looking very, very unpleasant and very unfriendly, the Fed basically stepped in and just said, we're going to throw a wall of cash into the US economy. And that cash, of course, finds a way into different places in different ways. And one is into the markets, and the other one is into real estate. And so those areas have been supported very nicely by that inflow of cash. It doesn't do much to help the overall state of the economy. I mean, I think there's a divergence of opinions between what central bankers think and maybe what some other people think in terms of monetary policy. Central bankers seem to think this helps the economy. Printing more pieces of green paper somehow is beneficial and will lift all boats. But in reality, what it seems to do is it seems to find its way into certain sectors first and lift the prices in those areas more quickly. And that's certainly real estate, the stock market, and other areas like that, particularly areas where you can borrow money to buy things. And there the effect is amplified. And that's certainly the case in real estate. So that's going to keep those prices up for the foreseeable future.
All right. So it's kind of, we go back to the Austrian School of Economics, which says that when you print money, create money out of thin air, you wind up seeing certain sectors, flows into certain sectors and not into others. So you wind up, you have this almost perverse effect where prices of certain things like real estate and the stock market, perhaps the collectibles market, see them going up, while other things really are going down, not doing well at all. When we look at the overall market, when we look at retail, for instance, in the United States, you've got a selection of bankruptcies. Some of the companies I didn't even realize were on here. They're old standard retailers. Like Neiman Marcus, which is more a financial issue than the actual underlying business being so bad. Roots USA, old standard retailer, many of you might not be familiar with. Tier One, well, they were gone. But a lot of these realtors, as you take note of, have Gordon Taylor, I think, was one of the oldest. A lot of these retailers were really in trouble. before the pandemic and wound up, that was the final nail in the coffin, if you will.
I think you're absolutely right. And I very much appreciate your summary of the Austrian School of Economics. You did that in a very nice way. There's a few people, I think, are even aware of their theories, but they seem to fit this kind of environment very well and explain monetary dynamics very, very nicely. So if people are not familiar with that school of thought, I would very much encourage them to read it. I think they have a very good explanation for this kind of business cycle that we see and these ups and downs. Of course, they don't predict pandemics, but they do explain what monetary policy does and how it impacts the markets. In terms of the retailers that you mentioned, yes, you might throw in there a few more to be sort of pleasant and nice. There was Lord & Taylor, or there was Ann Taylor, the Ascena bankruptcy, there was JCPenney and people of that sort. But you're absolutely right. These were retailers that were struggling quite badly beforehand and probably extended their shelf life by quite a bit through very, very low interest debt financing. So probably survived longer than they could have survived in a typical environment. And then with COVID-19, finally gave it the throw in the towel. But they might, some of them might be kicking themselves now in terms of having done that, because if you look at what's happened in retailing, it's done quite well overall, and it hasn't done as badly as maybe people expected. So in the very early days of the lockdowns, sort of mid-March, early to mid-April, we saw some decline in terms of amounts of money being spent in retailing. But since then, things have been pretty good, and the past few months have been very positive indeed. So we've seen substantial increases there. Right across the board in terms of retailing, with a handful of exceptions, maybe luxury goods an exception. But things have gone very, very well there. And I think you can explain that because a lot of consumers' disposable income in the past was taken up with things like travel and entertainment and restaurants and stuff like that. And those things have done miserably well, which means the consumer has more disposable income available, and retailers have picked up the slack there.
That makes a lot of sense. So when you really look at it, you see, travel is a huge sector. It's very costly, from hotels, rental cars, airline tickets, all of this. And now that sector, I mean, well, for the most part, international travel, actually flying to places, has really been shut down. Local tourist destinations, like in Florida, we have Key West. Key West has been doing pretty well. The local places that you could drive to within 2 to 3 hours, a lot of those resorts doing well, a lot of Airbnbs doing well, because people seek to further reduce their travel expenditures. And Airbnb is a perfect way, because you can go rent an entire condo someplace for $60 a night, whereas the hotel will cost you $300, and then they nickel and dime you for everything. God forbid you get thirsty in the middle of the night and you drink a bottle of mineral water. It's $5. So there's winners here and there's losers. It's becoming obvious, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's always winners and losers, but here it's been kind of clear. But personally, I very rarely stay in hotels now. It's always Airbnb. That's sort of my first choice. And it usually works quite well. Sometimes there's mishaps, but overall it's worked pretty well for me. But I think that's been the general trend, is that people have been somewhat more cautious about how they spend their money. There's some uncertainty, so people are sort of trying to put aside a bit more, looking for bargains. And you saw things like secondhand car sales advance quite nicely, and prices for secondhand cars in the US advance quite substantially. So that's happened there as well. I think, you know, you talk about tourism and the lack of international travel. I mean, there's one market that is particularly interesting there, and I don't know how much this is going to interest you, but if you look at the Chinese market, China runs a huge deficit in terms of tourism, which means the Chinese spend much more abroad than foreign tourists coming to China spend there. And that, of course, has stopped. So the Chinese are not able to travel abroad anymore. So they're basically, all the tourism is going to be domestically focused. So that should have a very positive impact on China's balance of payments, because there is a large, large deficit on the tourism side for the Chinese.
Interesting. I hadn't really considered that, but it makes total sense, because whereas the rest of the world has, most part, been traveling for decades, really post-World War II, and especially since the 60s with the advent of jet travel, the Chinese have been locked in their country and had this almost insatiable thirst to see the rest of the world. And now that's kind of been put on hold. So about China, their economy, we heard some rosy numbers the other day. First quarter GDP second quarter was up 4.9%. And a lot of economists are skeptical about these numbers.
Well, I suppose that's the thing about China. You can always be skeptical about the numbers, and people always are. So it seems that they're sometimes politically convenient numbers and sometimes manipulated. But I dare say that happens in most economies. I think if you look at the numbers that the US government puts out or governments in Europe put out, there is some margin for error there. And I think there's a tendency to make them look rosier than they are. But I will say 4.9%, it was a bit below what the sort of consensus of economists expected, but not far below that. But it's certainly moving in the right direction. So in the first quarter, there was a contraction. And second quarter, they were growing at 3.2% and now at 4.9%. So that's pretty encouraging. I mean, that's going quite well. Within China, if you look more closely, there's certain things that sort of indicate that things have recovered much better than that. So if you look at imports and exports, those both grew above double digits or close to double digits. You've seen industrial output grow quite substantially. The area that's been lagging has been consumer spending, and that's what brought the numbers in lower than expected. But that might take care of itself as these things unwind. So I think Chinese looks pretty good in the Chinese economy. I don't think there's much area for concern there, really.
All right. Well, they've recovered from what they've inflicted upon the rest of the world. Good for them. So looking ahead here at gold, which we spend a lot of time looking at, we've seen a very substantial increase in precious metals prices. We saw a new nominal record set over $2,000. Now it's hovering right in the low $1,900. What do you think we're going to see looking ahead for that?
Well, with all the money that the Fed has plowed into the markets, there is a substantial risk of sort of more general price inflation taking hold. And gold is always viewed as a hedge against that. You mentioned uncertainty and unrest with the election. I think that speaks to gold as well. So the combination of political uncertainty, potentially violence, as you pointed out, civil unrest, things of that sort, and then a very expansive monetary policy should very much be in gold's favor. So that might take off quite quickly. I suppose the issue is a bit that it seems that Bitcoin is becoming some sort of safe haven currency as well, and a bit of a competitor to gold. And so that might attract some of the investment that gold traditionally would have attracted might go to Bitcoin instead. And we've certainly seen Bitcoin advance enormously just the past day or two, but that's for other reasons than I think overall.
All right. Yeah, well, Bitcoin is interesting because it's been kind of in the dumps since it began its descent in the end of 2017, 2018. It was stuck, couldn't get over 12,000. Again, now it's broken 12,000. You think it's headed higher?
Well, I mean, just today, today it was up like 15% at one point. I haven't looked in the last few minutes, but it just had to sort up. But that was more because PayPal had announced that they were going to accept Bitcoin as a payment medium on their platform. So that has some people sort of thinking, well, now Bitcoin's finally going to become sort of a mainstream currency and it's going to move in that direction. It is a bit of a weird constellation of construction, Bitcoin, I must say. I think it's a substantial risk that once it does start to take over a substantial portion of payments and trading volumes, if it gets there, that governments and central banks will simply shut them down. I don't think the governments want people encroaching on their monopoly over the money supply. And Bitcoin raises that threat. So I think as soon as it looks like it's going to get above a few percent of the overall payment system, the governments might well be tempted to say, no more of this. We're going to push up this down because there's too much crime or terrorism being financed, yeah, tax evasion, things like that. They'll find some pretext to get rid of it.
Couldn't agree with you more. And they do have the ability to actually shut it down, although many people seem to believe that they don't. But I know they can shut it down for a fact. And it might be a false, what would we say, a false safe haven, right?
When you say you know for a fact that it can be shut down, what are you referring to? I mean, you're talking about actually unplugging the servers and the Bitcoin miners?
Well, not so much unplugging the servers, but for where the distributed ledger system to work. For the blockchain to work, it requires nodes. And there's only 7,000 nodes is the last number. It's probably gone down since then, half of which are in China. And for these nodes, because there's such a limited number, if governments decide they want to take it out, it's gone. and they know exactly where the nodes are because you just open up a map. So they can either physically bust the places and shut down the nodes, or they can actually block them through some type of some type of cyber attack on the nodes. And you only need to bring it down for a couple of days for it to become useless. If you have no price discovery in Bitcoin for more than 24 hours, I think that's the end of Bitcoin.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
With multi-million ounce potential at its Yellowknife District project, Goldterra is a company on the move. You'll find them at goldterracorp.com, and their ticker on the OTC is TRXXF. On the TSX, it's YGT. The management team is headed up by near legend Gerald Panaton of Detour Gold fame, who's convinced that Yellowknife's potential is far greater than its current 735,000 ounce resource. The mine benefits from great infrastructure. Employees can pick up breakfast at Tim Hortons on the way to work. And there's multiple high-grade discoveries putting Goldterra on track to reestablishing Yellowknife as one of the premier gold mining districts in Canada. And that should do wonders for the stock price as well. So head on over to GoldterraCorp.com and sign up for their notifications now.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Yeah, I think you're right. They can certainly do something technical on that side, but they could just go out and ban it. Now, you as a upstanding citizen might decide, well, my government has banned the use of this currency, and therefore I'm going to adhere to that law, or I'm going to go into sort of the black market and hold this currency anyway. I think enough people would be discouraged by that kind of ban that the currency wouldn't stand a chance to really become a replacement for the dollar. So either way, I think the Bitcoin might well fall victim to its own success. If it is successful, governments will be tempted to shut it down.
Yeah, well, I always say to people who say, oh, Bitcoin, you know, they can't stop it. And I say, well, what happens when you're arrested for possession with intent to distribute Bitcoin? What do you think is going to happen then? I think it's easier to shut down Bitcoin than it is to shut down the global narcotics trade.
Which hasn't gone so well either, has it? They're still working on that one.
It's easier. It's not that it's effective, but the fact of the matter is that, when it's a different thing when there's millions of people and there's governments involved in this, and then you're looking at 7,000 Bitcoin nodes. I think it's a lot easier to get rid of that pesky Bitcoin than it is to get rid of the narcotics trade.
Indeed, you're probably right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting back to gold here, and that is one of our favorites.
I think the outlook for gold looks really good and encouraging. I mean, I think if we do have a sort of hung election in the US, a contested election, gold should do very, very well. Even if it's not a contested election, I mean, if either side wins, I dare say there might be a fair amount of civil unrest from the other side, the disappointed side, who might not be quite happy to accept the election results. But I think in the US, even longer term, there seems to be the stage set for sort of longer term social unrest and upheaval that might be a bigger thing than simply this election. There seems to be an undercurrent of discontent and dissatisfaction across a large swathe of the population for various reasons. And at the moment, it's sort of cries of systemic racism and things of that sort. But I think there's a substantial portion of the US population that feels they've been left behind a bit. And that has really what sort of led to Trump's success as a political factor. And that's not going away. That's probably getting worse with COVID. I mean, with COVID, we've probably seen the richest get even richer and the lower end of the spectrum suffering. So that, I think, we're seeing the stage set in the US for sort of longer term, not civil unrest or minor civil unrest or minor outbursts of violence and things of that sort that should help the price of gold and assets like that.
All right. Well, that's an interesting point that you raise. And it's kind of unraveling, worth turning. I've heard people refer to it. There certainly is an argument to be made for it. All empires eventually die, usually through self-inflicted wounds rather than from enemies. But nonetheless, they have a limited duration, and the American Empire could very well be on its last legs. That we're going to have to see. But it might be a more gradual unraveling, or it could be a rapid one. One moment, Rome was the center of the universe, and the next minute it literally ceased to exist. There was like a million people there, and then there's like 10,000. I don't know where all the people in the United States are going, but perhaps it breaks up into multiple countries. That seems to be a pattern when you have collapses, economic collapses, like the Soviet Union broke up all of its satellites. Many of them broke up. Interesting times for sure, Octavio. So assuming we don't have this massive breakup in the U.S. anytime soon, you think the stock market keeps heading higher?
I think it does. I think the Fed is not going to reverse course. They've said explicitly that they're going to carry with these ultra low interest rates for the foreseeable future. I think if there is any sort of a concerted downward effort on the part of the markets, the Fed will step in with even more aggressive monetary policy and prop up the markets. So I think Powell at the Fed is now sort of painted himself into a corner where he's almost obligated to step in every time the market goes down and pump more money in to make sure that it stays up. So I think it doesn't look like the markets are going to go down, at least at a nominal level. You know, they can print enough money to make the markets keep going up at a nominal level. And I think that's what we're going to see carry on. They seem fully committed to that course of action. And there's no turning back, I think, at this stage.
And that's an interesting phenomena that the underlying economy can be doing badly, and yet markets can be going higher.
Yeah, I mean,
a contradiction.
Well, I don't know if it is a contradiction. I mean, yes, to a certain extent. But no, let's say you have a printing press and you can print as much money as you want, which is what the Fed or other central banks are in a position to do. If for whatever reason, the Federal Open Markets Committee, rather than buying bonds to implement its monetary policy, were to start buying broccoli, they could drive the price of broccoli through the roof, even if the rest of the economy is doing very badly. So they could just, you know, say, okay, we're going to buy, you know, $500 billion worth of broccoli today on the open market, and it will soar like crazy, no matter how bad the rest of the economy is doing. So it's not really a contradiction, but it's just, I think it's a mistake to think that the price of stock is really tied to the fundamentals of the economy and the companies that make it up, rather than the monetary policy, which is probably the more important driver at this stage.
And that is an excellent point that you raise, and I totally agree with you, but I don't think you're suggesting that the U.S. go on a broccoli standard, are you?
Not anytime soon, no. I mean, my ideas on monetary policy are quite controversial, I think, overall, but I certainly don't think they're going to implement my broccoli suggestion. But I was just to illustrate the point that they can drive the price of anything up as far as they want. And what they've done is they've driven the price of bonds way, way up. And those things then find their way into the equities markets quite quickly, that cash, and drive up the equity markets. So I think that's the kind of scenario that we're looking at in this case.
Fascinating. It really is. Because, you know, before World War II, the U.S., the federal government really it was a minor player in GDP. And now it keeps increasing its share and increasing its share. And that isn't a positive sign. That is a negative sign for the future of the economy and for the standards of living of most of the inhabitants. So when you see governments expanding, and this is something we're seeing all over the country as well, all over the world, rather, besides the U.S. The U.S. might be leading it, but it's been happening for decades now.
Well, you're starting to sound a bit like a right-wing radical. You might have to go hide in the hills of Virginia somewhere in the Black Mountains to get away from it. But I think you're right. It's not necessarily a good thing. A lot of the major decisions about the economy are now being made on a political basis rather than an economic one, and that is not a good thing overall. So I would definitely echo that sentiment. But it doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. I think your point of view is becoming more and more a minority point of view. And it sounds a bit quaint. It almost sounds like you're fighting the lost battles of the 19th century in terms of government interference in the economy and the progressive movement. But for sure.
And yeah, the whole Austrian concept of free markets and everything else has had an ignominious death. And I don't see much coming. that's going to restore it, other than the failure of the system that they're trying to prop up now. And by then, it might be well be too late. Octavio, if we want to find out more about you, connect with you on the web, what is the best way to do that?
Go to our website, opimas.com. That's opimas.com. And you can drop me an email there.
Okay, well, you're going to be a regular on the show, not just because you agree with me. Honestly, I prefer to have people who don't agree with me oftentimes, because that's how you figure out how you test things. But let's face it, the case for gold is there. It's been going up. It's probably going to go up higher. Seen the stocks, the mining stocks, take off to the stratosphere. A lot of these companies up 5 to 10-fold overnight, if they had any prospects. But we've seen every single potential deposit in the world of gold is now economically feasible. Doesn't mean it's practical to mine. Just means that counting the numbers, it probably could be profitable. But once upon a time, they thought that was true in Las Vegas, that if you just built another casino, they would come. I think what's stopping future gold production as much as anything else, a shortage of qualified managements, a shortage of qualified mining engineers, and a shortage of qualified geologists. Don't really see that now, but once all these mines get going, we're going to see it then, and we'll see the salaries, the compensation for these professionals shoot through the moon, because we're just not producing enough of them. And that goes for any resource, really. Perhaps oil, there's enough now, perhaps there's too much, but in every other aspect, I think that's the situation we're facing here.
Well, that's an interesting point, that there's a bright future in being a gold miner. It seems like a very retro kind of job, but certainly I think you're right. That's going to be where a lot of the economic activity is going to be. Well, certainly there's a tremendous amount of growth there. I mean, it accounts for a very small portion of the overall economy, but they're going to be very, very busy for the next couple of years, I think.
You know what they say, everything old is eventually new again. You know, 1 minute wide lapels are the rave. The next minute you go into the narrow lapels and narrow ties. And then 20 years later, it's like, what happened? We're back to wide ties and wide lapels. And I think business really works in the same types of cycles. Maybe next time when you come on, we'll talk about cycles, your take on things. Okay.
Definitely. But I've got a closet full of suits that are just about to become in fashion again, the way you described. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, but you know what the problem is nobody goes to work anymore, because you're working from home and you really don't need a suit to go down and talk on the web to go have a Zoom conference like us. So
indeed.
But don't toss them yet, because they could become valuable collectibles to somebody is into vintage clothing. Anyway, that's it for now. Really appreciate you coming on, Octavio. It's an absolute pleasure. Any questions or comments for Octavio or myself, please email us, al@kerrylutz.com. Go over to our website, sign up for your free newsletter, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Octavio, believe it or not, about a year ago, I was thinking of changing the name of the show and the site, and something happened that made me feel like, hey, I'm still relevant. So here we are. Talk to you again real soon. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you very much. Bye.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.